Welcome to Worldview, the Engelsberg Ideas podcast, hosted by Ian Martin.
Where stands the West? Is it in retreat, and what are the next threats? That's the theme of our latest edition of Worldview. Following the chaotic, contested withdrawal of the US and its allies from Afghanistan and the 20th anniversary of 9/11, I sought the perspectives of three leading voices on these geopolitical challenges. Frank Gavin is director of the Henry Kissinger Center for Global Affairs at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. Suzanne Rain is visiting professor at the Department of War Studies at King's College London and an affiliate lecturer at the Centre for Geopolitics, Cambridge University. She served at the Foreign Office in London. And Brendan Sims is professor in the History of International Relations at the University of Cambridge. Frank, when we talk of the West, it's impossible not to think first really of the US. In the light of what happened in Kabul and the US and Western withdrawal from Afghanistan, what's really driving US foreign policy?
So it's an excellent and very important question, and I would divide it up into several categories. First, I think we're all, particularly right now, reflecting upon the 20 years that we have been through with what in the US has been called the War on Terror, with the anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. And I think the ending of the American commitment and the NATO commitment and the general Western commitment in Afghanistan clearly stands as a pivot point that is a reflection of the end of that 20-year period and a not particularly happy one, a one that I think causes us to reflect upon what we were actually doing in the last 20 years, how much success or failure there has been. I think right now there is this general sense that's reflected in the Biden administration's foreign policy that not only are they pivoting away from what drove that 20 years, but they're seeing it not necessarily as a success. But I think there's something deeper going on. There are larger tectonic forces that are at work that are affecting the West and they're affecting the world, of which there's great uncertainty. I think when you think about questions of world order, what is shaping the international system? We're at a point right now where during the Cold War, we had a very clear way of defining what the challenges, the dangers, and the opportunities were. In the period after the Cold War ended, we thought we had this opportunity through sort of a Fukuyama-esque spread of democracy and markets. After 9/11, we had this sense of the battle of the sort of West against these less enlightened forces. I think right now what is most troubling and most the clearest challenge that we're facing is that we don't actually know what the challenges are. And there are a lot of people in the Biden administration who will argue the transition out of Afghanistan is to focus on a theme that the Trump administration talked about, which is the return of great power politics, particularly the rise of China. And there's certainly some element to that. But of course, we throughout the world have just gone through the last 2 years of a global crisis of the commons, which was made far worse by the collapse of cooperation, in which the great power political model isn't necessarily that particularly helpful. And if you look at the effects of climate change, if you look at disinformation, if you look at economic volatility, if you look at all the sort of what I often call the problems of plenty or the excesses of globalization, we don't have institutions or particular solutions for that problem set. And I think right now we're in a transition point, but it's not one of those clear transition points like we saw in 1989 or 1991 or 1945. It's a period more akin to the 1970s, where there's a sense of being at loose ends, there's a sense of danger, there's a sense of dissatisfaction, and there's no clear road path. Now, obviously, the 70s ultimately generated that roadmap that we saw in the 80s, we saw through the Thatcher Revolution, the Reagan Revolution, and also revolutions in Western Europe and Japan in terms of governance and economics. But I'd say right now we're at this point where we're not even quite, we know what we've left, but we don't know where we're going.
Brendan Sims, do you think it's correct or not to see this in terms of American or Western defeat and retreat? Or is it, as Frank suggested, it's something we don't quite know yet because other forces are at work?
Well, it's clearly a defeat in the sense that it's a withdrawal after 20 years with the objectives, which of course had been evolving over time, not having been achieved. It's a very visible humiliation. But I agree that it's not actually a retreat in the global sense, because it's really a refocusing of attention. In other words, President Biden is not leaving Afghanistan to bring the United States home. He's leaving Afghanistan as part of a project to concentrate more on the threat from the People's Republic of China. And in that sense, he's continuing not merely the focus from the Trump administration, but of course from the Obama administration as well, with its famous pivot to Asia. And of course, U.S. defense spending has actually increased under the Biden administration, and U.S. military power is still the greatest power in the world. So I don't think there's a sense of U.S. retreat globally. I think it's just a case of the resetting of priorities.
And Suzanne Rhein, the experience in Afghanistan, obviously a searing experience, 20 years ago now. And in that period, of course, you know, the West has spent enormous resources on Afghanistan and attempting to solve the problem, and then departs. The Taliban are in power in Kabul. That is a defeat that, well, would have been kind of unimaginable 20 years ago, isn't it?
I'm not sure 20 years ago we would have imagined that anything would have taken the course that it has, actually. What it shows above all else is the horribleness of unintended consequences of starting one thing, and particularly the difficulty, once you've begun a military campaign of whatever kind, of essentially lining everything else up behind it, lining the diplomatic effort up behind it. I suppose I just wanted to pick up on something that Brendan and Frank both talked about, which is the end of a 20-year period. Well, it is the end of our 20-year period, but it's, of course, not the end of any 20-year period of anything from the perspective of the people who live in Afghanistan, or indeed from the perspective of, Islamist terrorists or Sunni Islam as a sort of political entity. And if you might allow me, Afghanistan matters for Islamist extremists in a way that I don't think people necessarily understand, because Afghanistan is the Khorasan, or it is part of the Khorasan, and that was a much larger geographical entity in another era. The Khorasan matters because there is a hadith, which is called the Hadith of the Black Banners, which is about Khorasan, which says, the armies will come from Khorasan with the black flags and they will not stop until they get to Jerusalem. And that is one of the apocalyptic hadiths that has been central to the Al-Qaeda, Daesh radicalizing narrative. So the idea that the armies with black flags are in Khorasan is really important. And actually, when Osama bin Laden moved from the Sudan to Afghanistan in 1996, 25 years ago, he said then to Time magazine, he said, I have found a safe place in the Hindu Kush in Khorasan. And that wasn't an accident. That's the design, along with the design of the banners. They have black flags for a reason. And even though the Taliban have a white one with black writing, that still links back to these sort of earliest times. So it's a design. It also, they believe it. They believe they live in Khorasan. And so the reemergence essentially of the Emirate in Khorasan is going to change things. And the idea that we've finished because it's 20 years and so we're going to do China now, I just think it's missing a huge amount of understanding of what it is actually that we've been trying to deal with.
Frank, do you think in that context, do you think the West was naive? We were obviously naive to a certain extent, but how naive?
So I would say a couple of things in response. The first thing I like to imagine you're a visitor from Mars, and say you come to the United States and you're looking to see what the situation is. And you say, wow, your democracy was threatened by an insurrection. You appeared to have a lunatic who was your leader. You have a populace that doesn't appear to trust expert opinion. You've had more people die of a pandemic than in all the wars since the beginning of the 20th century combined. Your climate appears to be burning down, and you have this great power rival that appears to be surpassing you in many ways. And that visitor from Mars, with all due respect, would say, what were you doing for the last 20 years? Is this really the investment that made sense? And the other thing I would add to this is there's an interesting generational pull. And I was with a bunch of PhD students. We had some bipartisan group of experts who were a certain age lamenting the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, the sort of humiliation, the defeat, what this said for the West. And everyone who was under the age of 35 looked like everyone over the age of 50 had lost their minds, because their experience with American power in this 20-year period has been an utter fiasco in Iraq, a disaster in Afghanistan, a financial crisis which left, at least generationally, them behind, the election of Donald Trump, a completely incompetent response to the pandemic, and a sort of collapse in most of these views of what the West is. And if you were to say to someone, say in 2005, that you could hand them a little phone that would have all the information in the world that anyone in the world could access for free, and they'd say, isn't this a good thing? And then to find out in 2021, it's actually one of the great threats. So my basic view is that this generates a whole series of really important questions, of which, to be honest, Afghanistan is completely irrelevant.
You got there to the heart of something I was going to get onto later, Frank, which is that there's this irony, surely, which is that we're discussing potentially the decline or retreat of the West and the shrinking of American power. But actually, American culture has never been more powerful and more all-seeing and all-knowing because of what's happened with the internet in the 20 years since 9/11.
So despite after giving that very negative view of a series of mistakes, I now want to turn to sort of the assets the West has, because I was thinking, I always wonder about the category of the West, if it's helpful or not. And as I was thinking about, because I actually agree, this sort of competition with China, it's not even clear what it means. One of the things the other exercise you want to go through is you want to ask yourself, 20 years from now, after we turn to the competition of China, what do we want to avoid having a discussion about, similar to what we're having now? How will we know we've been right, and how will we know we've had mistakes? And off the top, if the United States was to have a war with China and we were looking back on that, that would be an unmitigated disaster, right? And there's not a lot of thought given to how we avoid that, all while acknowledging China is in many ways, a horrific regime and has been behaving in a way that makes no sense. The second thing that would be a terrible outcome is that these problems of the commons that have tormented us for the last 2 years and are only going to get worse, that there's no global platform for dealing with them, right? I mean, to me, I'm still in a state of shock that, and I think we all are, at how poorly the West has performed, particularly the United States, after this crisis. I mean, the moment doesn't get worse than this. And so 20 years from now, if we haven't figured that part out, that's the second worst thing that can happen. And so working backwards from that. So then you say, okay, well, what's the good news story? I think, you know, when I was thinking, when you're talking about the West, one of the more clumsy things that I think has happened in both this country and in the United States is to talk about democracies. Because then China turns around and says, well, your form of government, look, you know, we've been far better at handling all these challenges. And I was thinking about all the assets. It's not about democracies. There's something about the West that has, and it's sort of four values that I would highlight in its governance: transparency, accountability, responsiveness, and innovation. And we in the United States and in Great Britain vary on how we do there. But I actually think over the long term, in certainly competing with most authoritarian states, but certainly competing with China, we will do fine. In fact, do quite well. The second thing I would say is that if you were to actually add up the calculations of the challenges China is going to face, it's not a very good looking asset bank. They've got, you know, the banking system that's about to collapse. They've got a demographic inversion where they're basically going to be a nation of old people with no one to pay for them. They're surrounded by enemies. And so I think knowing that there is a danger, and I think you're absolutely right, from transitioning right from Afghanistan to say, well, now China's the new thing. I think this is a period to think about, well, what actually, to your excellent question about what does it mean to be part of the West? We all understood that. What are those values and identifying them? And they might not necessarily, you know, democracy doesn't carry a lot of weight for anyone under 35. But if you were to say things like transparency, accountability, responsiveness, innovation, opportunity, then I think that idea of the West is as alive as ever. And again, the final thing I would say about this, and this is one thing, last couple of days in London, it's been a reminder to me, Great Britain and the United States are the two great immigrant societies in the world. And one of the things that both the United States and Great Britain have is, if you poll people who at great sacrifice leave their countries to come to another country, they love that country. They look at our complaints about our countries as utter nonsense. Like, if you're coming from the various places they come from, they look at you and they want to slap you and say, give me a break. When you sort of have that person who is cleaning offices or driving a car so that their daughter can go to medical school and become a neurosurgeon, which is what happens in this country and happens in the United States, that there is an element of intellectual, and I would even say spiritual, regeneration that happens both in the US and Great Britain. It would not surprise me if 30 years from now that the US has an Afghani president, someone who came over in this sort of, in this terrible moment right now, you know, grows up in the United States or grows up in Great Britain. And to me, that's something that's rare and unique. It generates its own sets of governing challenges. It can be very, very messy in real time, but it's the ultimate salvation, certainly. And that's not always a Western ideal. It's a very British and a very Anglo-American ideal. And that gives me faith, and that gives me sort of...
Yeah, so that's a very optimistic idea and a heartening idea. Susanna, I'm going to, when we talk in a little bit about threats and the nature of threats, I want to come back in a little while to the specific case of Afghanistan, which obviously what you raised earlier, you think that there's potentially still a very serious threat there. But on the bigger question of the West and how it views itself and how it's constructed and institutionally, it was possible, wasn't it, after the election of Joe Biden, to construct a narrative, a story of a reorganization or a reinvigoration of the West post-Trump. But you could see potentially a reorganized West emerging. Now, what's just happened with Kabul and the breakdown in the relationship, temporary or otherwise, between some Western powers and the administration in Washington, shakes the faith in that idea. The West does seem to be operationally in some kind of disarray. Is that fair?
So I suppose really operationally, it's probably still continuing to function. So alliances will be continuing to function. But... I mean, I remember I found when Biden talked about yesterday's war and, you know, dealing with today's and tomorrow's problems, you know, there was some stuff missing in that, which is how you deal with the things that you haven't fixed. And I remember I was in Islamabad when President Obama was elected. And it was really interesting. I mean, he was in the middle of a full-on fight with the Pakistani Taliban, who were coming down the Grand Trunk Road towards the capital. And Obama was elected, and Pakistanis, for the first time, were just so excited with this new American president who was going to just change things for the better. That was the sense, as we all had, this optimism. And it turned ever so quickly when it turned out that actually Obama wasn't actually going to change anything for the better at all from their perspective. And then, of course, he took a series of decisions which are essentially like the ones that Biden's just taken, which is to just pull back, but to pull back without really thinking through what the consequences are of your withdrawal. And I mean, clearly Frank and I come at this from utterly different directions, but one of the things that I think you could say about a lot of the sort of malaise that we've felt in our politics, certainly in the UK over the last 20 years, is that it is connected with the war on terror in different ways, and the way that our society relates to different parts of it within it. I mean, the way in the UK, the sort of the way that the Muslim community has felt singled out and treated differently, all stems from the terrorist act in the first place. You can say that it stems from our response to it, but it actually stems from the activity of a small group of Islamist extremists who are part of a much, much larger movement. And the reason I'm saying that is that, you know, I cannot conceive of an alliance of Western states choosing to take preemptive military action against another state, especially now. I think that the only people we dare to fight are the terrorist groups, are the non-state actors, are people who we think are sort of smaller than us. And I suppose what I think this has shown us these 20 years is that, in fact, they have a capability of reaching into our society and of messing with people's minds, which we underestimate. And in fact, a lot of their techniques, the sort of subversive techniques, the really innovative use of the internet to sow mistrust, to spread conspiracies. I mean, they are the kings and queens of conspiracy theories. They totally outdo the Russians and Chinese on all of that. So we underestimate them at our peril. And I'm not arguing that it is more important or less important than China. I'm simply saying that we have to accept that there is a large part of the world who have a different value system and belief system, and it's not the Chinese one. It's
understood.
It's Islam. Yeah. And I'm just going to finish with a quote from Osama bin Laden, because it sort of echoes what Frank was saying when he wrote his letter to the American people in 2002, and he said, "It is saddening to tell you that you are the worst civilization witnessed by the history of mankind." And it's worth reflecting, you know, that there's a lot of people who, if forced to choose, would pick that view over the one that we would want them to think. And we just need to think about what we do about that.
Brendan, I was reflecting, I mean, we're recording this on the eve of the anniversary of 9/11, and I was just reflecting earlier. It had the most extraordinary political impact, didn't it? And I was reflecting on how languid and relaxed politics seemed. It's kind of the end of the 1990s. Lots of terrible things happened in the 1990s, not least which happened in Rwanda. But it did feel as though the world was settled. In the US, there was an administration which was describing itself as compassionate conservative, pursuing the domestic agenda, primarily focused on education, as George Bush had been, you know, extending that at the agenda that had made him governor of Texas and then president of the United States. In the UK, there was New Labour. That seemed settled. There would never be another conservative government ever again, it seemed, for a while. And all of that changed on that day, didn't it? The Bush administration became a foreign policy administration, and the beginning of the end of New Labour followed pretty quickly. Actually, within 5 or 6 years, you could see the disintegration in the aftermath of the disaster in Iraq. Do you think was that a deliberate process? Do you think on the part of the Islamists, Suzanne said they were sort of messing with our minds and attempting to disrupt Western society? It succeeded, didn't it?
Well, that's always been the strategy of terrorists down the ages, which is to provoke a reaction, which you can then exploit, and that the society which has been attacked or the policy will then reveal its essence. I mean, that was very much also thinking of the Bader-Meinhof group in West Germany in the 70s. Whether we did or did not reveal ourselves, of course, is a matter of opinion. But I think ultimately, if we look at this in the wider perspective, I'm not minimizing, obviously, the impact of the failure in Afghanistan, but in the end, the classic themes of great power politics, which were in some ways obscured by 9/11, have reasserted themselves. So in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, there was actually quite a high level of cooperation with Putin's Russia. There seemed to be the possibility of working together with all kinds of regimes that one would not otherwise have contemplated. And yet quite quickly, you saw the cyber attack by Putin on Estonia, you had the war in Georgia, and then, of course, the occupation of the Crimea. Quite quickly, much of the rest of the world reverted to their preoccupations. And I think, in a sense, the withdrawal from Afghanistan was simply just the realization in the West that there are many other things that needed to be pursued. And I think it was more a setting of a signal, because, of course, in terms of cost, the Afghanistan war by now was a fairly low line item in the Pentagon's budget, partly, of course, because of the agreement with the Taliban. Had that been repudiated, there would have been renewed conflict. But I think it was more the case that the Biden administration was setting the tone, overruling the generals, most of whom wanted to stay, and saying, I'm my own man. Now, I agree with the critiques. I think the way it was handled and the decision itself possibly mistaken. But I think it underlying it was a clear strategy to say, the war on terror was a phase. It had its justification. But now there are greater challenges from the PRC, from Putin's Russia, and even at home. So to that extent, I don't see this as the disaster for the West that many others do. I think it's a defeat, it's a setback. But I think we see in the history of the West this constant cycle of defeat and renewal. And at least I hope this is an example of this in practice.
Just on Afghanistan specifically, and the switch from Afghanistan to Iraq, is that the root of the disaster, do you think, Frank? I mean, would it have been possible to stay focused on Afghanistan, not go to Iraq, or handle the Iraq challenge differently, and not invade, and have poured resources into Afghanistan on the model of course, it can't be South Korea or post-1945 Japan, but to have focused more American energy and concentration of effort there? Could history have been different?
That's a great question, and all history is obviously involving some counterfactuals. And I was reflecting upon this a bit the other day, because one wants to be careful not to have retrospective bias to say what were the challenges people faced in real time. And I remember the period very clearly, because it was when I first started teaching, and these things were very sharply drawn, particularly as out of my office, I stared at the LBJ library and would teach Fred Logoval's Choosing War, and we would do a Vietnam exercise. And I looked at my notes recently when I taught the course the semester before 9/11, saying, well, at least we don't have to worry about this ever again, right? Which is one of these terribly depressing things to read in your notes. What I will say is that when you're making these decisions, to be somewhat empathetic to what was faced, you have to assume the worst. I mean, and I think one of the things we forget about that fall, I'm very much a critic of how the Bush administration handled it, but What I do think is that, one, there was an expectation of more to come, right? And there was a lot of live intelligence that there was far worse to come. And you talk to people in that period and they completely blanch when they talk about what raw intelligence they were looking at. And of course, you had the sort of strange anthrax attack that everyone just assumed that this was the beginning. There was lots of rumors about WMDs. And so you had that period. And you also had a period where, as much as we want to pin the blame on decision makers, there was a collective, and you could call it hysteria, you could call it, you know, bonding together, whatever you called it, there was a collective response in the United States, which I remember at the time it feeling a bit off and feeling it would be problematic, but President Bush's approval ratings were higher than any president in history. And literally the most hawkish speeches, I remember being in a off the record discussion with Richard Holbrooke before in the war in Iraq. And it was the most hawkish conversation I'd ever had. Same with Jim Woolsey, right? Who was basically talking about, do we go to Tehran or Damascus next? And so you had this weird combination of collective hysteria with really unfortunate hubris, some of which had to do with the particular personalities in that administration. And I think that's where your excellent question about Afghanistan versus Iraq comes in, because the world was with the United States on Afghanistan. If you actually look at the process that they went through in forming a government, in a lot of ways, it was very, you know, the Afghanis came together. It's actually kind of a model process that worked really well. There's an argument, if you talk to people in the intelligence community, you know, some of my friends who were sort of involved on September 12th, you know, the 11 Pashtun speakers who, you know, were in there dealing with the tribes, they did very good things very, very quickly, right? And that, you know, once Tommy Frank showed up, to their mind, things sort of fell apart. And there's even an argument about, you know, what tools were more effective. But it's that transition to Iraq that the U.S. then lost the support of the world. And of course, there's, you know, the story of I mean, it was interesting to hear you talk about the decline of due labor, because, you know, Tony Blair's role in the story is such a odd and strange one, right? Jeez. We did a student exercise with Phil Zelico recently with some PhD students where the students were advising Tony Blair. And I could just see all the young people just wanting to throttle, you know, who were playing on the British team, like, say something before they went to, you know, Crawford for the big meeting where everything was decided. And it's such a, because there was leverage, right? And so, but I think to your question, it is interesting that we're now talking about Afghanistan as the disaster, when in fact, in those early days, everyone thought Afghanistan was the virtuous one, Iraq was the bad one. Iraq quickly went off the rails, even when things were going well, the U.S. had lost global support, and there was a real squandering of capital. And to Brendan's point, when you look at, you know, the United States was cooperating with Iran in the aftermath of 9/11, the North Koreans were willing to talk about their nuclear program. There was, sometimes that political capital is transitory, but it was squandered in extraordinary ways and very, very quickly. And I think there is an open question of how long it would have consisted, but even like the Bush-Putin relationship. And so I think that Afghanistan had its own history, its own problems. I think Joe Biden was right in 2009. And at the very least, I think when bin Laden was killed, that was probably the time to think about a serious transition. Others can argue, others know far more about it than me, but I don't think there's any doubting that Iraq was the sort of original sin of this moment where you started seeing a complete, more of this unraveling that you referred to.
Really interesting point about Tony Blair. And we were discussing just before recording, we were discussing Blair's response at the time, and I remember as a journalist being at the speech, you know, the kaleidoscope has been shaken speech at Labour Party conference, you know, a few weeks later, and thinking that the first 15 minutes, which kind of mined, you know, the Chicago speech, Blair, were absolutely brilliant and the perfect analysis of the situation. And then being appalled as he spiraled off into trying to sort out the Congo and Africa and fixing the Middle East, and thinking this guy is almost ahistorical. And also the service immediately after 9/11, where of course he wanted to stand shoulder to shoulder, but said we stand shoulder to shoulder with America, just like America did in May 1940, which is not necessarily an accurate reading of history and how the dates flowed. That's before Pearl Harbor. But what do you think, Suzanne? What happened with Blair? Because he then didn't, as Frank says, he didn't use that leverage, which people like Christopher Mayer, who was Washington ambassador at the time, he's told that story of just expecting the Thatcher-style moment where a Blair would say, right, okay, you have UK support, you don't have European support, but the UK is with you. That requires a proper coherent aftermath plan or something. But he didn't. He was mute. Why?
Oh, I don't know why he didn't say that. I mean, I think that Chicago speech was still the way. I mean, it's only 2 years before. So they'd spent the 1990s kind of testing the different prototypes for intervening in somebody else's problem and doing it in a way that minimised, you know, US or British or NATO casualties. And I think in that speech, he sets out his sort of ideal for we essentially solve all of our problems by making the world more like us. I mean, really paraphrasing it. And I think that was kind of the thing that was driving everything. And your really important question about the plan for what happens next, I think, there'll be plenty of generals who can come here and quote Clausewitz at you ad infinitum. But it was very interesting, and I was part of the invasion in 2003. One of the things that happened, which nobody expected, you never expect exactly what's going to happen, but I think it had been taken for granted that the war would sort of start, there'd be an invasion, and the Iraqi generals would surrender. And the US forces with British and whoever else would take the surrender of the Iraqi generals, and that would bring the Iraqi army over. And then essentially you'd have the structures of the state, which was a really strong, coherent state in the sense
of dictatorship.
Yeah. So the structures of the state would be there, the generals would bring all their thing, and then you would run it. And I remember the US military, it was the middle of March, and the US military column was pushing north past Nasiriyah, heading for Baghdad, and they expected to encounter Iraqi forces somewhere between Nasiriyah and Baghdad, which would be a big battle in the desert. And it just didn't happen. And they just carried on going and got to Baghdad. And the Iraqi forces had just melted away into the desert. When in fact, that seemed great at the time, but of course was a complete disaster. Because what that means is you don't know where they are, you don't know what they're doing, and they're certainly not going to help you put the country back together again. So what we had in Iraq was a country that was utterly broken in a way that it was actually sort of our grandparents' generation who were in Hamburg in 1945 who had seen that. But since then, no one. And again, I remember talking to some of the generals at the time. I said, you know, we have to create a state from the very beginning. You have to set up the rubbish collection. We have to fix electricity and water. We've got to do post driving licenses. And of course, all the Iraqis actually want to gun licenses, which we don't want to give them because that doesn't seem like the best idea. But so when you say kind of what went wrong, I don't think anyone expected it to break so much. And of course, that has a direct parallel with Afghanistan, because when something is that broken, every decision you take is a political act, even if you don't want it to be. We're going to hire this person instead of this person to run the local council. We're going to give a favour to this person, because he can connect the water. And before you know it, you've embedded yourself in a set of alliances and structures in their society that are going to be your undoing. And I think that happened in both countries in exactly the same way.
But to what extent was that, in that period, was that dictated by the personality, Frank, of some of the key players involved, like Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. I remember a British official at the time describing it to me and describing the theory, once it was clear it kind of gone wrong, as them thinking that they were reinventing the cavalry charge and that they had a creative, disruptive attitude to war. In Iraq, they thought they would go in, reinvent the cavalry charge, perhaps some process of a kind that Suzanne described would have taken place, and you wouldn't need to stay for all that long, or you wouldn't need, certainly Rumsfeld didn't want to replicate a West German style situation or a Japanese style situation. And was that about Rumsfeld and Cheney influencing Bush, or was it an accident? How do you see it?
So first of all, I think Suzanne's point on this is spot on. I think one of the things, the series of decisions or lack of decisions in many cases, was the reflection of that moment where when you think, you know, Sam Huntington, brilliant political theorist years ago, had talked about how people will pay a very high price for stability, right? To get their trash picked up, to get basic services. They don't care about elections if their electricity is not working, right? And this is sort of a, we know this, but people forgot that then. So that's sort of point one. And you know, we're amongst applied historians, there was this misapplication of the Germany and Japan example, which people have a tendency to forget. The occupation of both went very poorly for a couple of years. Yeah. In Japan, it was a disaster. In Germany, it was, and it wasn't clear how things were going to turn out. And it was touch and go in both places. There was some luck involved. But you also had societies that had certain institutional depth and a certain experience with actually running a Western country that didn't really exist. And then you always make all these trade-offs about who you work with, what institutions you keep going. And that certainly took place to a great extent in West Germany and Japan, where it did not take place in Iraq. So a lot of misunderstood lessons. I was reflecting upon this recently, because a friend of mine who had been in policy planning at the time wrote a famous memo. People always say, oh, nobody reads anything that's historical or 30 pages long. He wrote a long memo about the difficulties with Reconstruction. He sent it up to the head of policy planning, Richard House, who sent it up under his name right up to Secretary of State Colin Powell. And it laid out why this was going to be difficult. And don't look at Germany and Japan, look at the Philippines, where the U.S. was there for decades and it didn't really work. But I also think at the end of the day, you can have these arguments about Rumsfeld, who I don't think bought into the freedom agenda, his deputy, who was all, Paul Wolfowitz, who was all about the freedom agenda. I think at the end of the day, you know, just like Blair was the key player here, despite a lot of his aides trying to push him in different directions and cabinet members, it's the same there. I think that President Bush felt this particular responsibility, obligation of the moment, and started imagining his role in this, and just imagined that people would want to embrace democracy and openness, and this would be easy, and it would be a process that would take place. It's actually, in retrospect, stunning the lack of preparation that was done. And it actually continued for quite some time. I mean, with Bremer showing up and then doing everything that and from what I understand, there was very little. They basically turned it over to the CPA. They didn't talk to the White House, didn't say what was going on. And it wasn't until the end of the year where people started realizing this, hey, this is really not working out. We really need to fix this. And then you have the disaster, and then you have a whole different war that starts happening with the surge and post-surge. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think this is, you can look at the aides. I think the Robert Draper book that just came out is very good on this. It was Bush. It was him and his view and his vision. He was ultimately responsible.
Do you think, Brendan, is it then, in that context, is it an excess of, for want of a better term, idealism? That naivety, the mistakes made were born out of an idea about how powerful the West is, and that if we wanted to make this, to remake this country, we could. Do you think is that a fair description?
I think that's certainly part of it. And I should declare at the outset that I was a supporter of the removal of Saddam Hussein. I was more optimistic about the prospects for democratic transformation, and that was a mistake. I don't think it was the original reason for the invasion, neither in Afghanistan nor in Iraq. I mean, in both cases, in the first case, it was obviously response to directly to 9/11 and a clear threat. And in the case of Iraq, it was very much the supposed threat of weapons of mass destruction. And it then evolved in both cases into a transformation effort, because in Afghanistan, it was felt you couldn't withdraw and then it would just simply revert to being what it was before. And in the case of Iraq, it was almost a rescuing of the original failure, if you like. I think it arose partly out of a sense that the previous solutions hadn't worked. So the previous attitude to the Middle East had been democracy is not possible there. Therefore, we should work. And if we do have democracy, we will likely get Islamists. Therefore, we should work with essentially strongmen and dictators. That, in fact, had only produced Islamists of one sort and another. And so therefore, the policy that people like myself supported was to say, actually, you need a democratic transformation, because then you wouldn't get, at least in the long run, Islamists.
And also out of that, Blair's theory, which was very powerful at the time, and I found persuasive, the idea that if you didn't try and solve some of the problems, you would then create regimes which, that showed what they could do on 9/11. Imagine that times 10 with a dirty bomb or some other
exactly. So there was a real sense of threat. Obviously now the prevailing view is that interventions don't work and to a certain extent provoke even greater problems than they solve. And yet if we look at Syria, it's very clear that's the one place we didn't intervene, but is the one place, certainly from the European point of view, which has produced many, many more problems, both in terms of terrorism and in terms of demographic shifts that have profoundly changed, in fact, the nature of European society. And that, let's remind ourselves, is the result of non-intervention. And of course, we intervened in Libya a few years after having failed in Iraq. So I think the jury is, and I say this not just in a self-interested sense, I just mean from the point of view of an historian, the jury is out. It always is. These things are cyclical. So whatever mistakes we made in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we made many, we will continue to intervene and we will continue to make mistakes. But hopefully, as Samuel Beckett once said, we tried again, failed again, but we failed better. And if we can do that, maybe something will have been learned.
Well, you've preempted my final question, so I'll ask Suzanne first and then Frank about the future, really. What then, what are the possibilities? What are the threats now? How should we be thinking about things?
My worry is that there's a whole lot of stuff that we just don't want to think about anymore because we're tired of thinking about it. And what that means is that we will devote less resource to it in terms of putting fewer people in countries which are difficult or no longer is sort of something we want to invest in. And as we do that, we understand less about the problem. And in particular, I mean, the sort of really obvious example is Biden's over the horizon capability. I mean, if you're looking from so far away, the chances of you're really understanding what you're firing at reduce the greater the distance, I suppose. So the risk is that that not understanding is sort of paralleled with a not know. So we don't understand what's going on in these places. We don't understand what people want and what they're thinking in a way that arguably we didn't in Afghanistan, even though we thought we did. And then it becomes not knowing in terms of whether or not they pose any threat to us. And that can be, that's not just a terrorist attack. That's also a threat of just very, very subtle, gradual changes in the mindset of millions of people around the world who we want to be part of our democratic political entities, but may just have a completely different view of how things should properly be done. And then at the acute end of that is the risk of further attacks. And as you would have heard Ken McCallum on BBC Radio Today programme saying, you know, attacks are going to happen anyway. We can't stop everything. It's never going to be the case that you're going to be able to stand up and say there isn't going to be a terrorist attack. This defeat in Afghanistan is an immediate emboldener of people who will have a go, and you just have to try and manage that risk. But the much greater thing is it creates, again, the potential space for people to plan something more sophisticated. And we won't necessarily know whether that's happening or not. So it becomes a really, really difficult risk judgment that the people who are trying to stop attacks have to take.
And he, of course, in that interview that you mentioned there, of course, he's the head of MI5. He gave a very eloquent description of working as an official then, working on the question of Northern Ireland and terrorism, and watching the second plane go into the tower on that terrible day, and saying Osama bin Laden, or one of his colleagues, said that, and saying that's what we're going to be doing for the next 10 years, dealing with the consequences of that act, and so much has flowed from it. But then, Frank, what about the next 10 years? How do you see things? You mentioned there global institutions, concerns about cooperation. What needs to happen looking forward?
Sure. Well, and I think that all of the dangers that Suzanne pointed out are very real and should be a concern. But I think basically the way I come at this is the world is a dangerous place. It's always a dangerous place. And you have to go through ruthless prioritization. And let's not forget, we didn't lose in Afghanistan. We just decided not to be there anymore. There's nobody that doubts that the United States decided tomorrow to invade Afghanistan with 500,000 people and occupy it. It could do it. We know how to kill terrorists. We have no problem doing that. And the question is, it's what actually happened? There was a sense that the investment in this enterprise was actually occluding our view of what our interests and true threats were. Not that there aren't threats there. Whatever the next terrible thing that's going to be happen is something that none of us here sitting have thought about, because that's how the world works and it's how you respond to it that's the issue. And I think it's just a sense that this 20-year effort no longer reflected what the dangers, the priority dangers will be for the next 10 or 20 years. And there's three that I think about. The first is the loss. You've mentioned the West a lot. As we've been talking, I've been thinking about the loss of confidence or belief in ourselves, in our institutions, in our values, part of which is truly a generational thing. We're here all above a certain age. I mean, talk to anyone under the age of 35, either in this country or in the United States, and you get a very different view. And that worries me quite a bit. So it's the opposite problem of the 2002 problem, where there was hubris and an overbelief. There's this draining sense of confidence. And I would argue some of what the mistakes of the last 20 years contributed to that. It's not the only thing. There's lots of other factors. But that is something we need to think about. That is something that not politics necessarily deals with. The second is you have a country with over a billion people that is positing an alternative way of organizing their society and thinking about the world with great confidence and even cockiness and even aggression. I think actually there's as much danger of them falling apart as there is taking over. But how to think about China is really of a fundamental importance. And the third thing is the thing I mentioned, is that we have these existential global planetary issues. I mean, I'm as realist as the next person. I was a John Mearsheimer student, you know, when he wrote, you know, Why We'll Miss the Cold War. It was like making fun of all what he used to call the peace, love, and dope crowd that talked about these kind of things. But the fact is, if this last year and a half has not taught us anything, it's that these problems are potentially existential and are not going away. And number two and three are related, right? If China and the U.S. are at each other's throats in a great power political competition that could lead to war, that's going to make this the third set of issues, these planetary issues, worse. And those worsening third planetary issues, it's a bad feedback loop, and we don't have sort of a way to think about it. And so to my mind, and again, terrorism would fall under those. One of the problems I have with how we've dealt with terrorism is putting in its own category, not seeing it as part of a series of profound global changes, of which there are many, many manifestations, which we have to think about. So I think, you know, the challenges are quite large.
Frank, Suzanne, Brendan, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Frank Gavin, Suzanne Rain, and Brendan Sims on the state of the West after Kabul. There was some fascinating insight there on how to view the recent history of intervention, tinged with an awareness that with hindsight, it's always easier to see what went wrong decades later. Thank you for joining me for the latest episode of Worldview on Engelsberg Ideas. I'm Ian Martin, and we'll be back soon with more geopolitical conversations with leading thinkers. Look out too for our other shows on EI and visit the website at engelsbergideas.com.
Worldview is an Engelsberg Ideas production for the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation. Recording and sound engineering by Story First Productions. Production by Francesca Peacock.